You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 18th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Yes, folks, it's vacation week. But again, it's vacation for us, but not for your ears. All new interviews for you. Today on the program, Simon Lazarus on the Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act, recess appointments. Ethan Rome, Executive Director of Healthcare for America Now, on the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. Shannon Browley from the New America Foundation, why too much medicine is making us sick. All three of those interviews I recorded several weeks ago at Families USA Health Action 2014. It's all new, folks, for you. Yes. So while I'm on vacation, partially in quotes, as I'm doing honey-do lists and, you know, cleaning diapers, not sleeping, you will get all this new material. And, of course, we have shows for you tomorrow and Thursday. Members will get some bonuses. Freebies will get real bonuses. Remember, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to majority.fm for 33 cents a day, folks. You can support this program, keep it alive, keep it thriving, make it better. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. You notice no difference whatsoever. Just simply go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, the Amazon logo. It'll take you to Amazon. Bookmark it. That's your Amazon. For now on, you will notice no difference. There's just a little tiny code embedded in there that says, hey, the Majority Report's going to get a little kickback. MajorityReportKickback.com. Pick up the app. It's free. MajorityApp.com. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. 10% discount. Coupon code Majority. Give us a review on iTunes, folks. Come on. Come on. All right, folks. Coming up, Simon Lazarus, then Ethan Rome, then Shannon Brownlee. See you tomorrow. Continuing our coverage at the Families USA Health Action 2014 conference, joining me now is The senior counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, Cy Lazarus. Cy, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Sam.
So there's a couple of things I want to talk to you about, Cy, but let's start first with the essentially what's happening in terms of the legal challenges to the Affordable Care Act. Where are we at? Are we done? Is it legal?
It is legal. We're not done.
Right.
Fervent opponents of the Affordable Care Act are in court or hoping to be in court, throwing every mud ball they can find at the wall and hoping that one might stick. There is only one that might stick, but last week a very distinguished district judge in the District of Columbia threw that one out, picked the mud ball up and threw it back.
And that is a case which is
one of four cases claiming that tax credits and subsidies to enable people who can't afford it to buy insurance on the exchanges can't do so on exchanges that are run by the federal government, which means in states which have not set up their own exchanges.
The argument here was that the legislation assumed that states would run their own exchanges, and in those situations, I think we have about 36 states where the governors said, we're not going to set up our own exchange. The feds are running that exchange for the state. And it really centered around the interpretation of a couple words, if I recall correctly.
You're exactly right, Sam. Something like 9 months after the law passed, some clever conservative legal beagles saw a little place in the law which, if you just read it by itself, could be interpreted to preclude the availability of subsidies in any federal exchange state, which really would have cut off or would cut off what is predicted to be 80% of the people who would want to buy insurance
right.
on the exchanges. And the federal judge in the District of Columbia instead agreed with the Justice Department's, I think, obviously correct argument that when you look at the entire statute, you see that it actually means what Congress intended it to mean and to make insurance more available, not less available.
So in terms of, broadly speaking, in terms of the legislation, once this case is settled, I mean, I guess there will be an appeal. But once this case is settled, the Affordable Care Act is basically it's settled law, and short of, I guess, sort of some marginal cases in terms of particularly around contraception and coverage and whatnot.
That's exactly right. But this particular case remains a somewhat dangerous case, and it's dangerous only because. There's a possibility the opponent's strategy really is to hope that they get the case up to the Supreme Court, and when they do, five conservative justices will think this is a Bush v. Gore moment, that is a moment when they should vote their political gut and not the best reading of the law. I don't think that will happen, but we need to be aware of the possibility.
You don't think it will happen once it rises?
I don't think so. I think that the idea that Senator Chuck Schumer and Senator Harry Reid got together off the Senate floor and said that I know what we'll do to induce states to create exchanges. We'll give our Republican opponents in those states the power to destroy the law altogether. What a sanction that would be. I mean, that just makes no sense, and I think it's too big a political lift for the conservative justices to decide to, as the opponents have said, drive a stake through the heart of Obamacare on that basis.
I mean, that raises, I mean, let's do a little backward looking for a moment, because I don't know, maybe it was a year and a half ago, I came down to D.C. Families USA had set up a radio row out in front of the Supreme Court, not out in front, but in a building next door. And we were talking about the challenges to the Affordable Care Act. And nearly every legal scholar I spoke to at the time talked about, I think there were four elements to the case. The last element that would come up in every conversation was the idea that somehow the Supreme Court was looking at the idea that because the federal government is expanding Medicaid, that this, somehow this was coercive to the states. And to a person, almost every legal scholar I spoke to at that time said, I'm not even sure why this is in there, because it's almost inconceivable that that they could find that this was coercive and problematic, and the implications for the Commerce Clause would be huge. Looking back, I mean, what does that tell us about the Supreme Court, that in fact, that's where that turned out to be the one sort of element that did not withstand the Supreme Court scrutiny?
Well, frankly, I had always said that the Medicaid expansion issue was the sleeper issue in the case.
I did not speak to you at that time, and I guess I've learned my lesson.
I was not so shocked. Frankly, the reason is that liberals don't read conservative writing and legal scholarship. If you did do that, you would understand that a lot of conservative scholars, whom the conservative justices, of course, look to and for inspiration, thought that the way in which the states were induced to go along with Medicaid expansion, namely by facing a choice between doing that and giving up all of their existing Medicaid benefits, there was a real argument that is, after all, a common sense person on the street would say it's coercive. There's no precedent supporting it, but never, just as a matter of common sense, it could seem coercive, and that's what happened. And so I actually don't think that part of the decision was so wild, radical, unpredictable, or unprincipled. There are other things in the decision I was not so happy about, but not that.
Really? What were the other aspects of that decision?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court, the five-person majority, Chief Justice Roberts, upheld the constitutionality of the individual mandate, but only as a tax, and he ruled, along with the four very conservative dissenters, that the individual mandate was outside Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. That was totally at odds with precedent, and I think also totally at odds with good sense and appropriate interpretation. And I think that only happened because Chief Justice Roberts felt a lot of pressure from his right to do something that they were demanding.
Fascinating. Let me just get back to the issue of the Medicaid expansion, because isn't it also the case that had the federal government decided, you know what, we're going to shut down Medicaid, restart it, and it's just going to be bigger, that would have been okay, right? I mean,
absolutely, that would have been okay, but it's not so easy to do that. I mean, that really wasn't a politically realistic option.
No, of course not. But and one wouldn't have anticipated. But you're suggesting that, I mean, that part of the ruling was sort of the principled, was more principled, or was it?
Well, I didn't support that. I didn't agree with that part of the ruling, but I understood the argument for it. I certainly knew that there was a lot of conservative legal thinking that uh-huh. would tend in that direction. So I wasn't blindsided by the fact that the argument was being made. And I can see their point, is what I'm saying. I don't think it's a crazy argument. And I think that actually it's very unfortunate. Half the states, poor people, are not going to be receiving Medicaid assistance that they should, and that's a tragedy and an outrage. And by the way, I think that it'll change over time. I think that once the law is clearly in place and people are receiving benefits in other states, I would imagine that it'll be much more difficult for reactionary forces in these recalcitrant states to resist the pressure to accept a lot of federal money and benefit their people. But I can understand the argument. I don't think it's completely nuts.
All right, let's turn to another case that is actually in front of the Supreme Court now that they're going to be deciding upon, which has gotten, I think, very little attention, particularly since the deal in the Senate the move in the Senate to get rid of the filibuster when it comes to presidential nominees. There's a case now, and I'm not even sure what I know what it's called, frankly, who the plaintiff and defendant are. But this is dealing with the notion of what constitutes a recess in the context of a recess appointment. Just take us back a little bit on the history about this and how certain appointments to the National Labor Relations Board were actually found to be invalid because of this.
So here's what's going on. Here's what's going on in that case. Senate bitter enders were blocking three Obama nominations to the five seats on the National Labor Relations Board. Without at least one of those people on the board was legally disqualified from doing any business. It didn't have a quorum. So this was a wonderful way to literally shut down our labor law protections and eliminate the ability of the federal government to enforce 70-year-old fundamental protections for union organizing. And the question was whether or not the president, under these circumstances, was empowered to use his constitutional authority to make temporary appointments during a recess, even though the Senate was not technically in recess. It was having sham, phony sessions every 3 days to pretend that it was still in recess. He said, "This is a sham. I'm ignoring it." And the question is whether or not that is constitutional or not, or whether the court ought to intervene and tell the president it's not. Since the filibuster was ended for executive nominations, people thought this is no longer an important problem. Wrong. It's a really important problem. If the Republicans take the Senate, for example, in the next election, they can just shut parts of the federal government down just this way, by refusing to consider any high-level nominations to it. So I think it's a real crisis for progressive governance, for effective governance, and it's clearly an interbranch crisis of great magnitude. I hope the Supreme Court sees the importance of enabling the president to fulfill his constitutional duty to execute the laws. But I don't know what will happen.
This really is, when we talk about constitutional crises, this really is, because what we're seeing is essentially what amounts to nullification.
Absolutely.
And there does not seem to be a remedy for this. There does not even seem to have been, from the Constitution's perspective, anticipating the idea of, we've passed legislation, we've set up certain agencies to implement and execute this legislation, now, after the fact, people are deciding, we don't want that legislation. We don't have the ability to overturn it. Interestingly enough,
the framers of our old Constitution didn't foresee this specific type of situation, but they did see combat between the executive and legislative branch as an endemic part of the republic they were creating, and they felt it was really important to ensure that the president had means of, quote, self-defense. They used that word more than once in the Federalist Papers, of self-defense to prevent encroachments by the Congress, which is exactly what's going on. So I think that if we were to pay attention to what the framers contemplated in terms of regulating relations between Congress and the president, they would say this is a means of self-defense the president should be allowed to use. I don't know whether that's going to happen.
Or the court should come up with some other type of remedy, right? But I guess that would be going too far
I think this is we're in the middle of a very fundamental institutional conflict between Congress and the president, and the courts ought to stay out. That's what I think.
Interesting. Simon Lazarus, senior counsel for the Constitutional Accountability Center. I really appreciate your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Sam.
Continuing our coverage from Families USA Health Action 2014, I'm with the former executive director of Healthcare for America Now, Ethan Rome. Ethan, Healthcare for America Now has, in some ways, mission accomplished, at least for this round, I guess. So this gives us an opportunity to sort of look across the spectrum to other issues that I know that you've been working on and that you've been following. But let's, in particular, since you are dealing with a lot of these folks on a regular basis, one of the things that has happened in the past couple of weeks, I guess it was, that a fast-track authority was introduced in the Senate by outgoing Senator Max Baucus. Give me your sense of what's happening with Fast Track, and then what is so problematic with the TPP, because I know that you have a sense of this both from a sort of a labor perspective, but also from a pharmaceuticals perspective.
Trade is very important, and we all say that all the time, anytime anyone's talking about these trade agreements, and it is. But fundamentally, what these trade agreements have historically always been about is lowering the standards for environmental protection, for workers, for every regulation and law that we have. And the notion is very simple that with trade. It's that we want to equalize the regulations and the laws amongst countries. So they pick the worst countries, and they say, hey, let's bring ourselves down to that. So that's how, when we talk about the race to the bottom, that's what we mean. If people are making less money in other countries, then the way that these trade agreements are looked at is, well, that means that people are making more in the United States, and we can't have that. With this agreement, 11 countries in discussions, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is what it's called, and there's a couple of things that are really important to note that are so important, and one is it's happening behind closed doors.
Right. To the extent that we know anything about it, it has been essentially from either WikiLeaks, leaks of specific chapters, or sort of secondhand from congresspeople who have found this information out from constituents who are trade representatives who have leaked it to them.
Well, you just nailed it, because the only way the information has come out is through leaks. And so when you think about that, here's a process that's going to affect the nature of the sovereignty of the United States. And that's what we're talking about. And there's industry representatives out the wazoo. If you have a financial interest in this treaty, and if you represent an organization, a company that has like a gazillion dollars in profits, they call you up. They let you in this room. All the rest of us, no. And Congress has been upset about that. Some people aren't concerned about the contents of it, and some people are. All of those people in Congress are coming together because they have a congressional responsibility and opportunity to review trade agreements of this sort, and they're not getting a look at them at all. And when we talk in a moment about the impact, for example, on pharmaceutical prices, it's extraordinary, and it'll blow people away how it works.
Yeah, I want to talk about the pharmaceutical, but I just want to pick out one thing that you said that's important for people to understand, that this trade agreement does even more so than any other trade agreement, I think, and that is diminish the sovereignty of the country. So it's not only bringing it down to lowest common denominator in each specific field that we're talking about, environmental, labor, consumer protections, patent regulations, etc., but it is also even divorcing it from any given country and putting it in the hands of an industry panel and allowing essentially the corporations to dictate to the countries, you cannot pass any other regulation unless you pay us for any potential profit that we thought that we were going to make that we don't realize.
What's amazing about this process is that everything that you just said ordinarily would sound like it was made up.
Right.
Some crazy, paranoid lefty who says, oh, the country's
Or righty, gonna, for that you know, matter, right? A one-world government. Right. I mean, this is what they talk about in the
right.
Law Society.
Well, this is true, because let's be super, to be really specific about this. Once this is in place, if a country wants to appeal, essentially, a regulation that's more rigorous than they would like, that interferes, for example, with the ability of pharma to essentially make an unlimited amount of profits, they can appeal this regulation or law. Where do they go? They go to an international tribunal. And that tribunal can then make a decision on its own. And one of those decisions, to get really specific, in the United States would be to ban Medicare from having any ability to negotiate at bulk the prices of pharmaceuticals. Or, for those of us who want to see a public option in the future with the Affordable Care Act, they could preemptively say that a public option wouldn't be able to negotiate better prices with the pharmaceutical industry. And that would hurt, obviously, the public option from making other advances in achieving savings. And what's remarkable about that is a serious example of the sovereignty of the United States being trumped by an international tribunal that is effectively controlled by corporations.
Well, that tribunal is made up not of trade representative from country A, B, or C. My understanding is that that tribunal, to the extent that we know who it'll be made up of, are industry lawyers that rotate through.
We don't totally know yet. It's largely going to be controlled by industry folks. They're the only ones from the United States. They're the only ones besides the U.S. Trade Representative who are party to this agreement. Uh-huh. And that's the kind of thing that is just unconscionable, because what we know about the agreement is that it's horrible for this country and for the people in this country. But what we also know is that we don't know very much.
Right.
Because there's no transparency, which is a big word for people getting locked out.
Well, and that's why this battle over fast track authority is so huge here, because it is sure to create more opposition once we do know what is in there, because it's going to activate the you're going to see a lot of internet activists, I think. You're going to see a lot of copyright activists. You're going to see health and labor and consumer activists, et cetera. I mean, the Medicare provision is just, I mean, when people contemplate that, I think that's stunning to people, and I think that's a good way of illustrating it. So what is happening in terms of fast-track authority?
There's a fast-track bill that Senator Baucus has introduced in the Finance Committee. He's going to be leaving the Senate shortly to become an ambassador of China. And so that hopefully will get slowed down and get managed by Senator Wyden, who will be the next chair of finance. The concern, so that's like the particulars on the Congress. The concern about this, and this is why what people can do is contact their members of Congress and say, just vote no on fast track, and let's let folks internally fix it. But we don't need it. The problem with fast track is, like, that's a great example. Like, where did that come from? I mean, we could have fast tracked the affordable health care law. That would have been okay.
Right, and people should know what fast track authority is. Explain to them. You cannot. It's not subject to a filibuster in the Senate. It's not subject to amendments in the Senate. It's not subject to any amendments in the House. It's basically up or down vote, no messing around. Either you're for trade or you're against trade, and that's the way that they leverage this, right? And it also gives Congress people an out, doesn't it? So they can say, like, well, there was a lot of stuff in there I didn't like, but, you know, on balance, if it was 51% the things that I liked, that's why I had to vote for it, right?
Right.
It gives them cover.
I mean, I think that, and obviously the concern is, No one who's listening practically has ever heard of this Trans-Pacific Partnership thing, right?
Well,
and now,
this audience probably fairly, very...
Okay,
but,
all right.
But in general, yes, right. That is a safe assumption.
That's right, because this is like a highbrow thing
it's,
going
it's
on
true.
Here.
True.
You know, which I think. I don't want to say it that way. But, you know, most people don't know what it is. And now all they know is whatever it is, we have to be in a rush.
Right.
Right? We must get it done. And so it's this, like, awful policy missile that has a huge impact on people's lives in ways that they don't know, right? I mean, as it is, right now, Medicare can't negotiate better pharmaceutical prices. And so we've been having a fight in the Congress that we've been pushing to have a bigger fight over allowing, giving Medicare the power to do that. There's no reason to have that. No reason to have that battle if this prohibits it. The fast track stuff is an outrage because it's identifying a particular thing, right, a particular policy, and saying, for real, now we've had an emergency. We have an emergency right. that we didn't know we had. Right. That's what I mean. Right. For listeners or for members of Congress or others. Right. We didn't know we had a trade crisis, but now we do.
Right. And this has been obviously been negotiated for years. But the idea is that their argument as to why they need it is because if we can't show that we can't muscle this through, then it's tough for us to negotiate it. But the reality is. There's a reason why they need to muscle it through, because I think if people take a look at this thing, there's going to be problems both on the left and the right, frankly. But maybe the way to activate the right is to say that everybody at the TPP is wearing a blue helmet, and then they'll get concerned about this one world. Ethan Rome, the former executive director of Healthcare for America Now, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio.
Continuing our coverage from Families USA Health Action 2014 in Washington, D.C., with me now is Shannon Brownlee, Senior Vice President of the Lown Institute, but also author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer, which was named the best economics book in 2007 by the New York Times correspondent David Leonhardt. Shannon, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about, let's start with why and how is too much medicine making us sicker and poorer?
Well, poorer. We spend about $800 billion a year on tests, procedures, drugs, surgeries, hospitalizations that don't benefit patients. They make some people rich. The healthcare industry itself is $2.7 trillion a year, but they're not helping us, the patients.
And now, there was a great piece in The New Yorker a couple of years ago by Atul Gawande, I think it is, right?
Yes.
And he compared two Texas towns, I think for Medicare reimbursement rates, they were essentially controlled for their type of population, for socioeconomic.
The big difference was that McAllen, Texas has a way of practicing medicine, all the clinicians in the hospitals, that's very, very aggressive. And they ended up throwing a lot of procedures, tests, and hospitalizations at patients in McAllen that did not change their health outcomes.
And part of that was because they all owned those tests.
That's
and
right.
procedures,
they are,
right?
It was a very entrepreneurial model of medicine.
And so is that one of the things that's driving
absolutely.
Costs?
It's part of the problem. Medicine is a very big industry, and it makes a lot of money for a lot of people. And I'm not saying that your doctor is rubbing her hands together every time you walk in the office saying, oh, great, I get to send my kids to private school for another year. But it is part of what is driving the unnecessary care in this country is the fact that it's a for-profit system. But there are many, many reasons we have too much medicine and too much care. Some of it is defensive medicine. Doctors worry they're going to be sued if they don't give you that MRI or that CT scan. Some of it is that there's a lot of medicine that's practiced that isn't based on good science, or there's no science behind it.
Right. I mean, again, because it's interesting, because much of the conversations I've been having at this healthcare conference deals with the demand side of how you're going to get patients into the system and whatnot and make it more efficient. But at the end of the day, the reason why we spend double what the nearest Western industrialized country spends on healthcare, and we're talking even though we don't provide health insurance for all our citizens, the government still spends more than any other country. Is because the cost of our medicine is so expensive in this
country.
And
there are two reasons. It's because the price is very high. We pay more for a hip implant than they do in European countries. We pay our doctors more to take care of patients. We pay hospitals more for everything. We pay more for drugs. But the other reason is we also provide huge amounts of highly technological care that isn't benefiting patients.
And so is that just wasted care?
Absolute waste. And the estimate for how much of what we do is waste. Not only unnecessary care, but some fraud, administrative waste, et cetera, is between 40% and 50% of what we spend is waste.
Wow. So that's basically medical devices we're talking about, right?
It's people, it's labor, it's latex gloves, it's everything.
What do you mean by latex gloves?
Well, I mean, if you're doing a lot of procedures that aren't needed, you're using up a lot of gloves that didn't need to be used. I mean, it runs down the line from the highly expensive technological stuff to tongue depressors.
Okay, so how were other countries, let's say Canada and Great Britain, were they headed in the same trajectory and they just simply jumped off? They just basically jumped off the train at the right time
yes.
and before it became...
They did it early in the 20th century. So the National Health Service was formed in Great Britain in the early part of the 20th century. And it was based on ethical principles and moral principles, which is that health care should be seen as a right. And it was seen as a right in Great Britain and most of Europe and Canada. And so there are government programs that ensure that everyone has access to care. Now, that said, they are all headed in somewhat the same direction we are. They're just not doing it as fast as we are. Their healthcare costs are rising, too. And part of it has to do with the fact that they deliver a lot of unnecessary care as well, just not as much as we do.
And, I mean, I guess there's somebody could write a book just sort of... just about the why that cultural, why they came to that notion of healthcare as a right, hopefully earlier than us rather than ever in terms of our country. And I imagine part of that had to do with sort of the devastation of World War II.
Yes,
frankly. But so what do we do now? I mean, because you know, not only we didn't get off that train built up speed and this and that. I mean, even the idea of the medical device tax that was imposed by the Affordable Care Act, which was basically a clawback from the 20% to 30% extra profits they were going to get because of all the new customers the Affordable Care Act was going to bring them, even that was like pulling teeth. I mean, not to...
Well, if you really want to get down to it, it's because we buy our politics. I mean, at the base, we have allowed the medical industrial complex to buy Congress. So that's one of the fundamental problems, is that Congress is beholden to these industries in a very, very direct way. But the other piece of it has to do with culture.
Oh, I want to get to the culture part, but we also see this in the context of pharmaceuticals too, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry is the biggest single industry that donates to congressional war chests.
And so, all right, so what's the cultural aspect?
So the cultural piece is that we've now, as a people, become convinced of the idea that more is better when it comes to health care. And in fact, we know that not enough care hurts people. But what Americans need to understand is too much care can also hurt you as well. And we have to start changing that culture on the demand side, on the patient side. But we're also working at the Lown Institute to change the culture within medicine, because I can tell you that there are many, many doctors and nurses and other healthcare practitioners who are completely discouraged by the way they see medicine being practiced around them, the very high focus on profit. And they want to go back to practicing for patients. And they, if they start working together, if they start really pushing on the system, they will be able to start changing the way things are.
Well, let's talk about this, because I think it's virtually impossible to expect to change the behavior of the demand side or the expectations of a patient walking into a doctor's office. To change their perspective, they're the last piece that falls, and frankly, they're the easiest piece. It's almost like they're the lowest hanging fruit, but they're on the top of the tree.
They're the hardest to get to.
Because because the doctor, you know, I don't know anything about what's going on with my health if it's not sort of a flashing red light. I walk into the doctor's office, and the doctor could say to me, you are in tip-top shape, and I would be just as surprised, frankly, if he said, you've got something seriously wrong with you. I think that is the number one aspect of being a patient is that you just don't know. You're going to trust your doctor. Your doctor says you need this, you do it. Your doctor says you need that, you do it. If your cousin who's a doctor or who has a doctor says that you need this, you're going to go and ask your doctor for it and find out why you didn't get it. I mean, so this really has to happen amongst the medical profession.
Yes, it does. I mean, there is no demand that a patient makes that was not created by the healthcare industry.
Right.
There is no surgery, there is no test that a patient thinks they need that was not advertised to some degree by the healthcare industry. And so I think you're absolutely right. To expect patients to turn this ship is not a reasonable expectation. Now, that is the basis for a lot of the healthcare reform that is being proposed, which is to, in effect, give patients skin in the game. But, you know, patients already have skin in the game. They're the ones who are getting the procedures and the surgeries.
Right, and then what you're talking about is conservatives want to privatize a lot of this stuff. They want to create health savings accounts that sort of you incentivize the patient to be a better consumer, which is ridiculous.
I think this is just nonsense because
I don't even think that would work with stereos.
No, it would work a whole lot better with stereos than it would with healthcare. The patient is the most vulnerable consumer there is.
Right.
A patient is sick, they're frightened, and they really need someone they can trust who is going to help them get better and tell them what's really going on. And that is the duty of the physician. That is the thing that the physician should be doing.
Now, I think, forgive me, I can't remember who said it, but trying to convince somebody of a fact that runs contrary to the way they make their living is the hardest thing in the world to do.
I think that might have been Will Rogers or Mark Twain, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure who it was.
Yes.
But, and I think I sort of butchered the quote. But the point being, so you have doctors out there who recognize what's happened to their profession, that it's been commodified and commercialized in a way that is now to the detriment of patients.
Yes.
But how is that reformed? I mean, do we need broader government reform? Are the payment distribution under Medicare or Medicaid, is that going to reform the way?
I don't think it can. I think that it has to start with, in effect, a movement within medicine that then builds the support for the kinds of policies that need to change and that builds support for patients to start to understand what has to change. The other way I think we're going to change it is for citizens, not patients, not individual patients, but citizens as groups to start saying, why are we paying for health care that is not, in fact, producing health? Why are we paying more than any other country to have the worst health in the developed world? What's wrong with this picture? And so I think that it's going to come from two directions. It's going to come from physicians and nurses coming together, and it's going to come from citizens starting to speak up.
How's it going to come from physicians and nurses? I mean, I can understand it coming from some, but I mean, how
is... There are a lot of them, and we're trying to organize them.
I mean, it almost seems to me that for reform to happen in an industry like that, that there has to be a certain amount of fear. It basically what it is you have to drive away the people, and it really has to do with in entering into the profession of those who are going exclusively to make money.
I think that's right. Now, there is a bit of a problem as well because many who go in,
you have to convince those people that they will not make money.
That's right. The other thing is that I think one of the things that happens to very idealistic young physicians and nurses is somewhere in the middle of their training, they lose a lot of their idealism. And so we have to rethink who we're choosing, and then we have to rethink how we're training. There are many, many things that have to happen to have a better system. And we're just at the beginning. And at the Lown Institute, we don't really know what we're going to do. We don't really know what these groups of physicians and nurses are going to do. But we know we're not going to stop.
Right. And so what do? You try and bring these people together?
We're trying to bring them together. We are giving them projects that raise awareness in their communities, in their hospitals, with their colleagues, with their peers. And one of the things we're actually trying to give them is a sense that they have, that they're not lone wolves, they're members of a pack, right, and that when they do speak up, there will be people supporting what they say.
When you meet with some of these people in this community and want to convince them of sort of this dynamic, is there a fact or two? Oh, okay. Is there a fact or two? We'll just finish up after this. Is there a fact or two that you can tell them that that sort of blows their socks off, that has the most impact?
Yes. The number of patients who are harmed by care that they don't need is phenomenal. It's in the hundreds of thousands. And I don't think most nurses and doctors recognize that. And when they do, they understand that it's really a serious, serious problem. And that they understand that it is, in fact, sapping our ability to care for people who really need the care.
Wow. All right. Well, Shannon Brownlee, Senior Vice President at the Lown Institute and author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. Thank you so much for your time today. Say it's an apple pay.